And welcome to episode 2 of the Ron and Brian podcast. Brian, how are you doing, sir?
I am doing fine. How are you doing?
All right. Are we calling this episode 2 or more episode 2.5?
I like calling it 2.1. This way it gives us the opportunity to do a 2.2 sometime later on tonight after I've had a few more drinks.
Right. I mean, for those of you that caught episode 1, the thousands, dare I say millions, that caught episode 1, you know, we are working through, would you say, technical difficulties? I know some people thought you were possibly in an elevator, in a submarine, in a phone booth in that last episode. But we're going to fix things. We're going to make it better for you, the fans.
Well, I was actually calling you from the underground in New York City. I went into the subway tunnels that exist between Queens and Manhattan. I wanted to see what kind of damage was still remaining from the hurricane that we had, Hurricane Sandy, where there was all that flooding that took place. So I called there. Acoustics, a little off.
A little bit.
Yes.
But I think this week, we're trying out some different locations, and I think you're going to notice a difference. At least I hope you do.
I sure hope so.
So, Brian, this week's show, a few different topics to cover. We actually had a chance to see each other face-to-face this past week as my wife and I headed up to New York City for a long weekend.
And how was your time here?
I mean, I love New York City. It's a city that doesn't sleep. And there's always something exciting, always something fun. You know, we started off on Thursday with the Jon Bon Jovi concert at Madison Square Garden, which was exciting.
I'm incredibly sorry that you had to do that to yourself.
I mean, I'm not a huge Jon Bon Jovi fan. There was definitely not a lot of men there. I was in the minority. But, you know, he still brings it. He still rocks out in a very safe, mediocre, rocking kind of way.
And yet, isn't it one of those shows where when you look at the demographics, it is 40-year-old women, white, I'm going to assume most of them were white. And yet there are a lot of men there, but there are no groups of men. You're not going to see two bros. There's no Chad and Brad hanging out, rocking out to Living in Sin. No, it is women who have brought their boyfriends, husbands, fiancés, bankers, sugar daddies, whatever the term that you use to define your relationship. Those are the men that are there.
I think you pretty much nailed it. You know, there was, you know, groups of women. It was definitely a girls' night out or, you know, a night where, you know, husbands had to kind of tag along with their wives.
Which is, you know, the way I see it in a good relationship, in a healthy relationship, one that's going to last, is that there are going to be opportunities where you are going to get dragged to things that your partner wants to go to and wants you to keep them company at. But there are also going to be things that you're going to drag them to that they don't want to go.
And when it's always a little bit of give and take.
When it's a one-sided type of relationship, things like that, you're not looking at a healthy relationship. So when you told me that you were going to see Bon Jovi, and if I remember correctly, I said, now, is this all her or is it partly you? If I remember correctly, you said that there was a part of you that said, I want to go see Jon Bon Jovi and crew.
There was a little part of that. As I have found, I'm not as big of a Bon Jovi fan as I thought. I don't know a lot of his music, as it turns out. And there's probably only really a handful of songs that I could listen to on an ongoing basis. There was a lot of stuff that he played that I was just like, I don't know this song and I don't know that I want to listen to it again. But overall, he puts on a good show. And the wife was happy. Happy wife, happy life.
Oh, I hate that phrase so much.
I had a feeling you would.
I hate that phrase so much because it implies that the happiness of a woman is more important than the happiness of a man in a relationship, when it should be a 50-50 balance.
Yes, I agree.
That we have somehow found an acceptable level of compromise wherein the man's role in a marriage is simply just to keep her away from nagging at me as much as possible, And that's my goal, is to limit her anger towards me.
I feel like we've hit on a sore subject. I mean, I'm just throwing that out there. Not necessarily a subject we need to explore tonight, but something we can definitely add to the list of future Rod and Brian topics.
If it makes you feel better, I am currently exploring that with my therapist.
Well, that's good. It's always good to have somebody to talk these things out with.
Well, I wish I didn't have to pay him.
It should be free. I mean, if helping people is really one's own reward, they should do it gratis.
Yeah, they should take my insurance.
Or that.
Yes.
So that was Thursday, a little JBJ. Friday, nice day in the city, so we went down to the High Line to walk along, take in some sun, take in some people watching, walk through Chelsea Market.
Now, for our listeners who are not familiar with the High Line, can you tell people what it is?
I guess at one point in New York's history, it was an elevated rail line, about a mile and a half, couple miles long. They stopped using it at some point, and I want to say it's probably 7 or 8 years ago, they rebuilt it into an elevated park. So you can basically walk from, I think we picked it up around 37th, and then you can take it all the way down to about 10th. So it's a good stretch. There's a lot of plant life, a lot of art installations. You can hop on and off in different neighborhoods. So when it's not crowded with a million people like it was on Friday, it's a great way to get around the city.
And what was the thing that stuck out in your mind that made you say, this is something people need to experience about it?
I guess having walked just the regular sidewalks of New York City, you don't see a lot of greenery. You don't hit a lot of areas that don't smell like urine. So I would say probably 50-50. The High Line doesn't reek of urine like most of the rest of the city. And there's a lot of, you know, green open space.
So what you're basically saying is that we need to spread the word to the homeless population of New York City about the existence of this elevated subway platform, that there is green, just grass that they can lay down on, catch a quick nap or whatnot. If they have to defecate, they can just lean over, drop a deuce, maybe drop a trice. I don't know. Whatever. I don't know what homeless people are doing nowadays. It's been a couple years since I was homeless. And, you know, just with the new technology, the different apps that are out there nowadays to just make life a little bit more connected for them.
Sure. There was a surprising lack of homeless people on the High Line. I'm not quite sure why that is. You would think they'd be drawn there with the tourist population, but didn't really notice too much.
They probably don't know it exists.
There was a heavy tourist population, especially in Chelsea Market. It was insanity. You know, I hate crowds. And all I know is I've discovered that getting the hell out of people's way seems to be purely an American thing. They do not have this in Europe or Asia, apparently. They will just walk you right down versus maybe letting you get around or sharing the sidewalk.
But I think that there's a certain extent of, because they are vacationing in New York City, they're not as concerned about the people behind them as they are taking in the visuals and experiencing what they are, where they are right now.
And I'm all right with the slow walkers. It's more the people that just want to plow you down because, you know, you're standing there and they just want to get through.
I hate them all.
Really? You seem like such a people person to me.
No, not really. Not really. So after the High Line, where'd you go?
After the High Line, that was when we made our way back to Times Square, where we were staying, and where we met up with you.
Yes. Wasn't it pleasant?
It was. It's always good to see you in person. This Skype connection, you know, the camera only does so much. Sometimes I just want to hold you, smell your musk.
I have a complaint with Skype because I believe it adds 5 pounds. You know, when
for me, it adds about 15.
You looked so slim in person, and yet on the Skype visual that I'm looking at right now, you look like you got a couple on you, and that's not true. Not true. You're nice and you're fit. You're trim. You're healthy looking. I got to meet the famous wife.
Yes.
And she
was excited. She loves her new best friend, Brian. No question about it.
Can you blame her?
No. I mean, what's not to love?
Oh, we had a great chat. We had a great chat. Fueled by alcohol, I will say.
Quite a bit of alcohol. You know, I told her prior to, you know, her meeting you, she was like, oh, do you think he'll mind if I ask him about this, if I ask him about that? And I said, you know, if there's one thing I know about Brian, the man is an open book and will tell you anything. And you certainly lived up to that description.
It's one of the things that I feel that is, I don't know, it sounds more glorified than it actually is. But if I could say that there's a mission in my life, a purpose, a reason why I'm on this planet, and what I have kind of, the niche that I have found in this world is to try to let people know that it's okay to talk about things that are personal and sensitive, that we can interact with each other and not feel like we're being judged, that it's okay to open up. You're not going to get shunned. You're not going to be made fun of, whatnot. So I've made it my one-man personal mission to just be an open book, not be afraid to talk about things because it's part of life, and just let people know this is me, this is who I am. And I like to know that other people, the people I'm interacting with, they can do the same.
You're a straight shooter, no question.
I'd like to think so, except I was never homeless, so I was lying earlier.
That's okay. We could have kept that from the people. So we hung out, had a few drinks. It really turned into an extended drinking situation for a few hours.
It was a fun time, not only catching up with you, but also meeting your wife and finding out. She really is a delightful woman. I can absolutely understand.
Well,
I can understand why you married her.
I'm fond of her.
I would like to have her on as a guest one time.
She is more than willing to come talk about whatever it is we want to talk about.
Oh, having met her, I know she's very willing to come on as a guest. That's that's not going to be a problem.
Right. So after that, we went to dinner. I know you had some plans. We headed somewhere. I can't remember the name of the place because the rest of the evening, to be quite frank, is a little hazy.
Was it local? Was it a walking distance? Did you have to take a cab?
Yeah, it was within walking distance. I know we tried to go to some rooftop bar, but there was too long of a wait. So we were like, let's just go someplace with an open table. And then we headed back to the hotel to kind of sleep it off.
Any reasonable person in New York is not going to look for a rooftop bar. The people that go to the people that go to rooftop bars in New York City are the people that want to be seen at a rooftop bar.
Interesting.
There is a very high douche factor at a rooftop bar. I've gone to them a couple times, always dragged by other people. I've never sat there and said to someone, hey, what are you doing on Friday? Let's go to a rooftop bar where flies and mosquitoes can land in our drinks while we sit there and sip $15 vodka tonics. Which I'd like to say, just a fantastic summer beverage. but it's not a place where it's a place for people watching. It's a place for to be seen. It's not a place where people connect.
Understood. So we didn't miss out on much by that.
No, not at all. So what did you do on Saturday?
So Saturday, slept in a little bit, slept off the hangover. Grabbed a late breakfast and picked up a couple of tickets to see The Boys and the Band on Broadway.
Now,
for a limited 15-week engagement.
Which got even more limited when the star, I believe, looked out into the audience as he was walking off, saw that you were there staring at him, and immediately tripped and sprained his ankle.
Got a little distracted, apparently. Fell down the little mini flight of stairs at the end of the play, and you know, it very clearly twisted his ankle pretty badly. Like they had to help him to his feet, and you could tell just standing there, he was in a good amount of pain. So that was Jim Parsons, is the lead in that play.
Now,
you may know as Sheldon from The Big Bang Theory, or not. I would hope that you wouldn't.
I have never watched a full episode of that. I have flipped channels. I've seen it on TV. I've never watched a full episode.
Well, I'm proud of you for that.
Have you?
We watch it a bit just to fill the void in evenings.
Why can't you guys just talk to each other? Just pour two glasses of wine, light a candle, sit down on the couch facing each other, and just talk about your deepest secrets and fears.
I'll see if I can get that going. But it was a very good play. I will say, much better actor than I knew. Actually, the whole cast was pretty good. Zachary Quinto's in there, Matt Donner, a bunch of other people whose names escape me at the moment. But packed house, and we almost bought tickets to the 8 p.m. show instead of the 2 p.m., which obviously we would have been disappointed when that 8 p.m. show got canceled due to the injury he suffered during our performance, which I feel we're responsible for.
Now, would you have looted?
Probably. I think,
a little rioting?
You have to loot,
right?
If you're in New York City, you have to loot a little bit.
But New York
but
is
we are not... It's a looting town account. A looting kind of town, no doubt about it.
I don't know about this. New Yorkers don't historically loot. I mean, the last time we had a real looting issue was back in, I think it was 78 or 79, when the city had a blackout for several days. And there was some looting in some the less economically advantaged parts of the town. But for the most part, the looting is I would say, at least for the past 20 years, looting is more of a response to some type of social outrage, whether it be
maybe we could have brought it back.
Absolutely. No, Jim Parsons, we won't go. I'm going to go get me a 60-inch TV.
But you do kind of feel bad for the people. Like, if you saw their Facebook page, there were people that literally had traveled from other countries to New York City to specifically see this play for it to be canceled on them.
And you don't get it like a slight perverse chuckle out of it.
All right, maybe just a little bit.
See,
just
that's
a skosh.
Own it. That's what I'm talking about. Just like own it. Like, why pretend that you feel bad? Like, genuinely, do I feel bad? No, but do I understand? But also, that's the risk you take when you're making plans that involve other people. Now, had you traveled to town and said, hey, listen, I want to go to the High Line. I want to walk an elevated subway platform. Regardless of the weather, that's what I want to do. Now, you can say the odds of that happening are really good. Now, if you say I'm going to a Broadway show that I want to see these certain stars perform, I would imagine that there's going to be certain performances where understudies will be performing those roles. That is the roll of the dice you're taking.
There is. And I'm, the one thing I'm curious about is there is an understudy for his role, but for whatever reason, they decided to just cancel the performance rather than have the understudy do it.
Yes. Here's the question. Is the understudy the child actor who plays young Sheldon in the spinoff series?
Yeah, I'm not 100% certain, but I don't believe that's the case.
Because that would be really impressive if they had figured out how to do that.
Maybe so.
All right.
So did that. What did we do after the play? It's all kind of a haze now. Oh, went to one of my more favorite steakhouses, Ben and Jack's Steakhouse, for an early dinner.
Ooh, good call.
Have you been to Ben and Jack's?
Yes, I have.
Love Ben and Jack's. Love the Canadian bacon. The steak for two.
You went with the porterhouse?
Yes, of course.
You don't have to say, of course. Your woman's I would describe her as petite. I don't know that she's going to be taking down a 16-ounce filet. It's possible you guys split one.
We split it. I put down a good amount of American red meat. I mean, it was a great meal, as always. And then, again, back to the hotel to relax, unwind, catch a little Netflix, and your and mine favorite new Netflix show, which is...
Evil Genius.
The true story of America's most diabolical bank heist. So we blew through all 4 hours pretty easily.
Now, what I would say about Evil Genius, for those that are not familiar with it, is that it is the story of a bank robbery that went wrong. And I believe it took place in 2003. So we're looking backwards 15 years, and a lot can happen in time. Right. And I don't know whether you were following the story when it happened, but I know it captivated my imagination, because one of the things that I'm fascinated with is domestic terrorism, which we'll touch upon a little bit later. But it was, for those that are not familiar with the case, it is the death of Brian Wells, who is, excuse me, oh, I hate when I social faux pas. Brian Wells was a pizza delivery man in Erie, Pennsylvania. He did not work for one of the chains because he was a man of honor who sat there and said, no, I will not work for Domino's. No, I will not work for Little Caesars. No, I will not work for Pizza Hut. I will work for Mamma Mia Pizza in Erie, Pennsylvania, which apparently had a very bad luck because they lost two delivery guys in a very short period of time, which this show...
Within a week, I believe.
Yes. So the story that is that this show Evil Genius is based on is Brian Wells, pizza delivery man, takes a call for a pizza order. It was, now I know, it was a two pies with pepperoni and sausage, which is going to be my new favorite pizza. Although I don't think it's going to be good for my heart. However, so he takes an order. He's a delivery man. After the pizzas are ready, he gets in his car. He drives to make the delivery for pizzas. Next thing we know about him, he is walking into a PNC bank in Erie, Pennsylvania. He is wearing some type of contraption around his neck and chest, which is covered by a T-shirt. He hands the bank teller a note that says that he is robbing the bank. He asks for $250,000. Did not know that, but he apparently gets $8,000, which...
A little short.
Had to be disappointed. He exits the bank quickly and gets not very far as he is suddenly surrounded by police officers, where he lets them know that he was forced to rob this bank, that there is a bomb around his neck. The police do not believe him, so they cordon off the area. They surround him, but are maintaining a safe distance just in case he's telling the truth. And after within an hour or so, the bomb is suddenly detonated and Mr. Brian Wells dies.
Very graphically as well.
Oh, it was amazing. I don't want to spoil it, but yeah, he got blown up. He got blown up real good.
He done did got blown up.
Mm. Now, Ron, do you want to tell us a little bit about the documentary?
Well, I mean, a lot of it... You know, it goes through four episodes, about an hour each, a very quick watch, if there's such a thing. But it really focuses on these two individuals that they felt, as they did more investigation, were involved. This Bill Rothstein, a very large man, tall, favored bib overalls, and Marjorie Deal Armstrong, who was a fan of... I mean, I guess maybe a fan of Pink Floyd. She really liked to seem to shave off her eyebrows repeatedly.
That was weird.
Her look crazy in the least.
What's with the shaving of the eyebrows? They never touched upon it, but they kept referring to it. Like, they didn't ask the question of why she shaved her eyebrows, but there was an interview with somebody who was in prison with her. Spoiler alert, she goes to jail. But... She is in prison, and one of her cellmates says that she used to spend hours shaving her eyebrows.
Right. I mean, I guess if you just mention that somebody is shaving off their eyebrows, I guess it's just implied that they're a little bit nuts from that point on. That'd be my guess.
You know what? I would like not to. I don't want to judge people. I don't want to be the guy that judges people.
That's right, not you. So she was a little crazy.
Woo.
Definitely some mental illness there that was diagnosed by many people, but just never treated.
I believe that what they're really touching upon is that mental illness was not something that had been really accepted by society during the 1980s and 90s. It's only until the past 20 years where we've really gotten to a point where it's accepted. It's something that we don't judge people on. And I currently would like some antipsychotic medication.
Right. So the plot, you know, the documentary starts off kind of giving, running you through some of the stuff that a lot of us saw in the news, you know, the bank robbery, the bomb going off. One thing I did not realize, and I can understand why they left it out of the news, was the fact that they needed to decapitate Brian Wells to get the bomb off of his neck.
Oh, that was a fact that I did not have any idea about. And I like, actually, I pride myself on following these types of stories. But the police officers told the family of Brian Wells, who was the bank robber here, they said that as part of their police investigation, they needed to preserve the bomb device as much as possible. And they could not get it off of his neck. So what they had to do was decapitate him, chop off his head to remove the bomb. And they even had his brother, who was complaining that now they were not able to have a open casket funeral because there was no way for the funeral home to have the head resting in a realistic position.
Right. I mean, I guess they could have just really sat it on his stomach and then he could have been facing people right when he walked up. I mean, or there's definitely many ways you could have, you know, angled the body.
They could have gone with like the headlock, you know, which I think is very popular in Nepal. When somebody is decapitated, what they do is they tuck it underneath the armpit and just make it look like the person's in a wrestling move. But it is just, I watched it all today. I found it a fascinating piece of investigative work that the police, the FBI, the ATF did, because you are there throughout the entire story. There's a hint of, was Wells involved in it or not? How is it that he suddenly goes out to make a pizza delivery, appears in a bank about 25 minutes later with a bomb wrapped around his neck, which later explodes and causes his death? How does that happen? One would automatically assume that he would be instantly telling the police exactly what happened. Now, the story he told police at the time was that a couple African-American men were there when he tried to make his pizza delivery, and they put the bomb device on him. Now, it is something that the police immediately did not believe, which I think probably did not work in his benefit, as right off the bat, I think there was a believability issue with that the police had with him, which leads me to wonder, if he was not involved in it, why wasn't he honest with the police?
That's an excellent question.
Did you ask that question to yourself while watching it? Like, where did the story of blame it on African Americans come from?
Well, I believe they touched on it towards the end in the fourth episode, how he was instructed to blame a couple of African Americans were he to get caught. Now, whether that was the case or whether, you know, I think that was some of Ken Barnes' testimony during the documentary. But yeah, either way, at that point, if you're caught by the police, you've got a bomb wrapped around your neck. Like, let's be as upfront and honest as possible in the hopes that maybe, you know, they'll help you and this thing won't blow up around your neck.
If you put a bomb around my neck and I can hear it ticking and it starts beeping after a couple minutes, I don't care if you're my best friend, my nephew, my niece. I'm dropping names to the cops to get this thing off my neck. And I don't understand why this guy did not do that.
Again, I guess in that situation, maybe the stress was too much. I mean, I would imagine I'd be a little freaked out having a bomb strapped around my neck, but you never know.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
New York City trip.
On our 1 year anniversary of the Ron and Brian podcast, we will put matching neck bombs around each other with a timer, and we have to answer some crazy questions. For everyone we get wrong, we take a minute off the bomb.
All right. I'm up for it.
We're going to need it
forever.
No, but we're going to need an engineer to help put those bombs together. I will have to find somebody.
We'll have to see if there's somebody out there that might want to help with the engineering of that.
I believe there we may know someone now that I think about it who is in Saratoga County who's involved in politics. I don't want to name names because I don't think it's something that he's comfortable publicizing. But yes, I believe we have somebody who is very comfortable in explosives.
Well, now, one thing I'll argue with you about, as you mentioned about the investigative work of the police and the FBI and everything else, what kind of struck me a couple times during the documentary where they point to pieces of evidence that either were uncovered on a local or a state or a federal level, and for whatever reason, you know, that information wasn't communicated across to the ATF, to the FBI. I remember the one thing I liked was when they were showing the old clip of Geraldo speaking to the district attorney, and the district attorney ends up calling the FBI based off of Geraldo Rivera's tip that there is a eyewitness that would have placed Bill Rothstein and Marjorie at the gas station where the initial phone call came in. That guy was never interviewed, and this was a couple of years after the crime.
I think that what that exposes, if you let me go on a little bit of a tirade here, I think what it exposes is that there is a misconception amongst the population that any type of organization is inherently a well-organized, well-run entity and not simply a conglomerate of human beings. Now, when you think of human beings, you know that we're not perfect. You know that we make mistakes. And you're a manager at work. When one of your employees makes a mistake, do you sit there and just completely lose your cool? Do you sit there and say, okay, listen, you made a mistake. You know, I get it. I don't understand why you made the mistake, but okay, I guess you made the mistake. We instantly think that because the FBI is involved, that the FBI is going to respond and handle themselves any differently than a group of human beings. And one of the things that they touched upon early in the story is how this case was instantly an issue between the different law enforcement agencies as to who was prioritizing, who was going to handle the case, who was going to take lead on the case. The local law enforcement were involved. There was the FBI because it was a bank robbery. ATF was involved because there was a bomb. Now, this right off the bat sets off a case of interagency friction. Now, why do we believe that local police would work very hand in hand with FBI when the reality is that as human beings, the local police are the ones that want to solve the case. They're not going to want to be very forthcoming with all their information. You know, without the FBI doing a reciprocation, the FBI is not going to be trusting of the local agencies because they want to be the ones that get the collar. So what you end up happening is you've got different law enforcement agencies looking into the same crime, not communicating with each other. And it's something that you see far more often than agencies that are communicating very freely with each other.
Well, that seemed to be the point, I think, especially the gentleman from the ATF mentioned that he experienced that more in his career than not, where, you know, there's just, for whatever reason, an unwillingness to work, even though they're all trying to get to the same end.
Exactly.
But I give it 3 thumbs up, the additional third being, you know, one of Brian Wells' hands that I've kept here since 2003. A lot of people don't know that.
You shaved his finger?
The thumb, just the thumb, in case I ever needed it.
All right, I believe that.
But I digress. But the topic of evil genius kind of leads into our main topic of this podcast, that being domestic terrorism. And definitely, there were a few people in the documentary that referred to this as a terroristic act. I'm sure Brian Wells certainly would. Would you in fact define that as domestic terrorism?
Well, I think the issue that you're about to touch upon is what is the definition of domestic terrorism? As somebody who lives in New York City, where it is probably the largest terrorist target in terms of a location, I feel that terrorism is a I define it very widely. I believe it's okay. I believe it's any act of violence where the goal of the act is to cause some type of violence, where the effect of that will be fear amongst the populace that will cause them to change their behavior.
Now, but do you think that was the end game for the Brian Wells case, though?
No, not at all.
All right. So that we at least agree on.
Do I think that it was just some crazy white trash? Yes.
I will say the number of bib overall wearing people in the documentary was very eye-opening.
I saw so many overalls, flannel shirts. Oh, and the hoarding. How did we not talk about the hoarding? I know we moved on to domestic terrorism.
It's okay.
I am so fascinated by hoarders. My mother was a hoarder, and not in a in a gross dog feces kind of hoarding, but just in a sense of she didn't like throwing things out because in her mind, you never knew when you may need that later on. So she had literally bags of bags where she would get a large, say, department store bag, and she would fill that up with other bags. If she bought something at Macy's and they were like, would you like a box? She was like, of course I would like a box, even though she had 14 at home. But she was a believer. She was just a believer in, if it's free, I'm going to take it because I never know, I may need it later on. Now, my mother was a product of the Depression. She grew up very poor with very few possessions. So I can understand that as she grew up, she became a little bit more comfortable financially, yet there was still that in her subconscious, that mentality of I could lose it all at any moment and then go back to having nothing. So let me collect as much as I can now. What I don't understand are these people that literally create such a garbage shit show in their house that you literally don't have any walking room when you enter their house.
That's what the situation with most of these individuals. I mean, it wasn't just Marjorie's house. You know, they go to Ken Barnes's house. You know, they I forget who else they were in, but everybody's home was a literal shit show. Like, people who are on the TV show Hoarders are watching this documentary and saying, "We're not that bad."
I believe it was Barnes's house where they even said that upon entering his house, you actually had to immediately start stepping on stuff to the point where you were never sure how far away from the floor you were. That is a serious level of hoarding.
And I think one thing that like was shocking to me that you find out later out in the documentary, you know, obviously Marjorie does a little jail time, but they took everything from her house and they put it in storage because they figured they might need to go through it eventually. And they managed to do that. Like, who was the poor schmuck that had to like categorize, you know, the 8,500 copies of Good Housekeeping she had or whatever else was, I mean, and the stench just had to be, because they were finding dead animals. They were finding, like you said, human feces, waste remains. I mean, it was, I don't know how people can live that way.
You know what? I'll be honest with you when it comes to watching that stuff. And we could talk about hoarders and we'll probably never get to domestic terrorism. But the thing that I find utterly fascinating is that it starts off small, builds up and builds up to the point where there's no going backwards. And right. What I find fascinating about it is that the hoarders, the people that just collect, what, like, at some point they lived in a clean house. You know, they dusted, they vacuumed, they swept, they picked up the cat feces off the floor, they washed, there was a working toilet. How many episodes of Hoarders have you watched? And that might be a rhetorical question. I don't know what your viewing habits of it were. But how many episodes of Hoarding were there where the person, the main subject of the show, literally did not have a working toilet?
Oh, yeah. Working toilet, tub, ovens. I mean, even anything that you would, whatever a item was designed for in the house, whether it was in a bathroom or in a kitchen, rarely worked. And it was just used, either it was used to store things in, or there was just some sort of ungodly filth in it that you would just not ever want to wish on anybody.
At what point, upon losing your functioning toilet, do you sit there and go, you know what, I'm not going to bother calling the plumber. I'm just going to let it go and start taking a dump in a bucket, which I'll pour out the backyard once a week. Like, that's the point. Like, how do you get to that point? I can understand not throwing stuff out. I can understand letting it build up. I can understand having a messy house. I cannot understand the losing the functionality of just the basic human just hygiene. I don't get it.
Maybe that's again, it's a mental illness. And I will admit, I've watched quite a few episodes of Hoarders. There's always that trigger. There's always some sort of like mental shock that occurred somewhere in their life that drives them to, you know, hoarding, you know, whatever. In Marjorie's case, it was also dead boyfriends she hoarded. They actually stored the dead boyfriend in the freezer, which was a lot cleaner than she had stored most anything else in her house.
Now, the dead boyfriend is just completely unrelated to the bank robbery. That's the beauty of it all. Yeah.
Possibly. There's a chance that he may have found out about it, and that's why he was killed. Or she may have just killed him for shits and giggles.
I've done it before.
I mean, that's another thing that, you know, again, I've never killed anybody that you're aware of. But why would you not get rid of the body? Why put the body in a freezer in your house? That, to me, seems like you're just asking to get caught.
See, my take on that, and it's not something necessarily I've put a lot of time and thought into, but if I had a large freezer in my basement and somehow somebody found themselves dead in my house, I would think that if I was afraid that calling the police would put me in a negative light, I think I would sit there and say, you know what, I'm going to put them in a freezer for now until I figure out a sure-proof way to get rid of the body later.
Which I could see. Like, that part I get.
So it's kind of like, it's cadaver purgatory is the way I saw that freezer.
Well, again, you know, the smell obviously is the number one thing that's going to attract the authorities. So you freeze the body, so I get that. But maybe at that point, you put your bank robbery plans on hold and really focus your energies on what you're going to do with that dead body in the freezer. But, and at the very least, once you've failed in your bank robbery and killed somebody with a bomb, maybe you just say, all right, let's circle around, circle the wagons, think this through, and, maybe focus on getting rid of that dead body now.
Now, my question was, because I don't remember this, was the dead body after the bank robbery?
He was apparently shot and killed prior to the bank robbery because it was, he had been in the freezer for, I want to say, a good 3 weeks by that point. And then I forget however many, whether it was a month or so after that Bill Rothstein called the police to be like, hey, I've got a dead body in my freezer. Who are these dead people?
I don't want to have to go get a commercial meat grinder to shove this frozen corpse through.
And what I loved, I mean, you know, Bill Rothstein in the documentary, you know, he tells the one FBI guy, you know, I'm the smartest guy in the room. But then he does that thing with the suicide note where I don't know if he was actually contemplating suicide or what have you when the police were coming to arrest him for having the body in his freezer. But the first thing, you know, in his suicide note was, oh, by the way, this has nothing to do with the murder of Brian Wells. Like, that's exactly what someone who's involved in the murder of Brian Wells would say. And it's the first thing you put in your suicide note.
And to me, that is that's the weakness in a lot of these geniuses, which is hubris. It's right. The idea that because they are, because they know more than the other person in the room, because they are smarter than the other person in the room, therefore they will always be able to outthink the other person. And you're not going to always be able to do that. So when you've gotten away with murder, think about it. Had Bill Rothstein never picked up the phone and called the police, would they have ever found that body? Likely no.
Right. It would have been very, very doubtful because they really, at that point, had no clues. I mean, they, you know, really had put together almost the perfect crime as far as making sure they didn't buy any of the components of the bomb anywhere. You know, it was mostly scavenged material, all constructed themselves. Like, all the things you see, you know, people screwing up with being caught on camera or having credit card trails or what have you, none of that existed in this case. And they had really no clues whatsoever.
Which is why they were able to get away with it. It was right. It was the fact that it reached the point where they felt that they were smarter than the police and that they would be able to point the police towards one crime without bringing any attention to this other crime that they had committed. That they thought that they were going to be able to control the dialogue, that they were going to be able to control the focus, that they would be able to say to the different law enforcement agencies, pay attention to this, but not that. And that is the downfall of most of these people, is the fact that because they think that they're smarter, they slip up in some way, and that's usually where they get them.
So if you're out there planning a crime, just don't brag about it. If you get away with it, just don't say anything. Move on.
Get the commercial meat grinder. Get the commercial wood chipper. Whatever you have to do to get rid of that body. I mean, even if it's just like sitting it out for 4 days, like a Thanksgiving turkey to thaw out, and then just sit there and mush it up with something. I think we all learned in Breaking Bad exactly how to dissolve a body. You know what chemicals, you know which plastic tubs to get, even look underneath for the labels. And what you don't do is call the cops and say, oh, by the way, there's a body in the freezer in my basement.
Right. That's really where it starts to go off the rails.
But this is the problem. The problem is the fact that anytime there are more people involved in any type of criminal activity, it always introduces the idea of friction between them as to, I now have something on you. If I can go to the cops and spill the beans and talk about you, and I will be let go on an easy sentence, you're the one who's going to pay the price. There was I heard a phrase a few years ago that really stuck, which is three people can keep a secret as long as two people are dead.
Yes.
And it stuck a chord with me, which was absolutely. You know, if you commit a crime with three people, you better kill the other two, because now they know something about you that can bring you down.
And do you think maybe that was maybe the thought process behind what Bill Rothstein did, is he felt maybe, you know, he could get off easy by cooperating with the police and put Marjorie in jail in the hopes that, you know, that would put one of his co-conspirators away. And she's obviously probably not going to admit to anything herself.
And isn't that exactly what happened?
Yeah. But then, Bill dies of lymphoma. So, I mean, maybe Bill knew his time on this planet was short. You know, I mean, he died, what, just months after he went to the police.
Now, if you notice, he died of cancer as well as Marjorie Diehl did as well.
Yes. Yep.
What's with the cancer in Erie, Pennsylvania? What are the odds of two people who live completely an unhealthy existence? First off, it says a lot about the pizza from Mamma Mia Pizzeria in Erie, Pennsylvania. I hope they're not still in business anymore, because I do not wish to defame them. But what I would, basically, you know, we know that they ordered pizza from there. Is it possible that Mamma Mia Pizzeria in Erie, Pennsylvania causes cancer?
Theoretically, allegedly. Although I'm sure the hoarding probably didn't help.
Oh, it was so disgusting. The photos. I feel like I need to go back into hoarding. The TV show, not the lifestyle.
Okay. That's good.
What I find interesting, actually, is that I think as a result of watching my mother keep shit, like as much as possible, is that I genuinely feel good about throwing out stuff, and not necessarily throwing out garbage, but just in the sense of getting things out of the house, whether it is putting together a bag of old clothes to donate, or finding a stack of singles that you didn't know you had from the last night at the strip club and just burning them because you don't even want them in the house anymore. I mean, who deals with singles anymore? It's Ron, you were supposed to react to that.
Sorry. I don't have a good sound effect for that.
No, but I find myself genuinely feeling good about getting things out of the house. And I,
well, it's
and
good
that's,
to purge and clean up and organize from time to time.
And yet you deal with these people like on TV and in real life, obviously, in terms of the hoarding, where it's a goal of constantly accumulating stuff. And what I find fascinating, and I love this, is the homeless population are incredible hoarders. Now, you would think that if you don't have a place to go home to tonight and you have one shopping cart that you have stolen from a local supermarket, that you would limit your possessions to that one shopping cart. But no, they literally pile stuff higher and higher and higher. They're literally like five levels deep in terms of stacking on top. And literally, it's garbage that they're collecting. It's things that right. have absolutely no value. There's one guy on the subway that I used to see very often when I was working, of course.
Is this the backpack guy?
Yes.
I love the backpack guy.
He had 16 backpacks. I counted one day. And what would happen is he would have someone on the front, some on his back, some on his front, more on his back. And it was literally to the point where it was like up to his neck. It was up to his neck. And he would get onto the subway at a certain stop. He would look for a seat. Now, as a homeless person on the New York City subway system, most people are very willing to give up their seat if you're in their area. So this guy would sit down and immediately take off the bags. Like, at what point do you not sit there and go, I already have 16 bags. Do I really need that 17? It looks like a fake Louis V bag. And you know what? I'm not carrying fake stuff. I'm not a Canal Street bougie bitch. I'm going to stop now. No, he takes the 17th bag because that's what he's all about.
It's all about those extra bags. Now, was he a talker? Because, I've noticed that the people in New York, the crazy ones, are either the really introverted ones that are just doing their crazy thing to them crazy selves, and then the people that just have to announce everything they're doing. And that's how I think you can tell when someone isn't used to New York City, because you can see the look of fear in their eye when somebody is going off on a crazy rant on the subway or on the sidewalk. Others of us who have been in New York City are just like, he's just having a conversation with the voices in his head.
The thing that I always like to do is, to me, that's like the gold standard is a homeless person that's speaking loudly. Sometimes they'll be directing their conversation at strangers. They'll look across and start talking, be like, "Hey, bitch, what are you looking at?" And like, I will immediately turn off whatever music is playing on my phone because I actually want to hear this stuff. I'm the person that like takes a couple steps closer to the homeless person. The people that get up and flee, they have no idea the entertainment that they're losing out on. I feel so bad for them.
I mean, we went into a Duane Reade after the concert just to get a couple of bottles of water, and there was some guy just yelling about something. And he had an earpiece in, so you never know if they're actually on the phone with someone or just yelling in general. But even the security guard was just like, yep, he's just yelling, that's all. Like, no concern to escort him off of the property or whatsoever.
The security guard probably knows his name, knows right. You know, like which days of the week he comes in, and understands that he's not a threat.
I mean, he had a Duane Reade keychain in his hand, so clearly he's a member of their preferred shopping club.
Listen, for every $100 you spend, you get $2.50 back. I mean, that's smart economics.
That's a bargain. You can't beat that with a stick.
Well, I'm looking at the time, and it looks like we're not going to get to domestic terrorism this week, my friends.
So this is for those of us that used to listen to the show back in the day. We would tend to go off on tangents every once in a while, but I like to think it's still entertaining. I might have to go watch some Hoarding. I may have to even go watch some of Evil Genius again just to... I feel there's a lot of nuances that you miss just watching it straight through.
Let's put it this way. I downloaded all four episodes onto my iPad, and I will be watching them again.
Awesome.
Yes.
So we are hopefully going to have a very good audio experience with our new system that we have set up here. We do hope that people listen, but more importantly, we do hope that people reach out to us. Brian, how can they email us?
Well, they can reach out to us via email at ronandbrianpodcast@gmail.com. They can reach out to our Facebook page, which is Ron and Brian Podcast. They can reach out to us on Twitter. I believe it is also Ron and Brian Podcast. And they can, I also believe that we will answer smoke signals if put out properly.
Of course. There's always a way to get a hold of us. So we're going to wrap it up for this week. We'd like to thank you all for joining us. We're going to play a little of our new little outro music going on here. Brian, always good to see you, sir. We will
Same
talk
here,
again
sir.
Soon.
All right, sir.